Thiessen was a German steel magnate who was also a big financier of the Nazis.
Also, you heard a reference to Herr von Schnitzler. He was a key member of the key director of IG Farben.
Indeed. Now, once again, I want to make this point. Now, here the Germans, through Hjalmar Schacht, and the French Vichy supporters, the pro-Nazi French industrialists, have discovered that the Americans are going to be invading North Africa. Well, now, you might think at this time, if these people were real diehards and real, gonna fight to the death for their countries, et cetera, that they would be indeed withdrawing money from Africa, you know, where it might be in danger, et cetera, if they felt that there was a danger that the U.S. were gonna take their financial supplies away from them and bringing them back to Paris, which was still under Nazi occupation. No, in fact, these people were transferring their money in large amounts into North Africa. And one has to feel that they were fairly secure in their belief that, in fact, the Americans were not going to tamper with their industrial holdings whatsoever. And, in fact, that they would be safer in the hands of the Americans than in war-torn Europe.
Keep in mind the American connections to these very same industrial interests. Recall that the aforementioned IG Farben Chemical Company was consolidated. It previously had been a bunch of independent companies, consolidated partially as a result of the money borrowed under the American reparations loans to Germany. Keep in mind that American IG's legal business was handled by the Dulles law firm Sullivan and Cromwell, and keep in mind in general the German-American industrial axis, because the Americans, and Alan Dulles was head of the Bern, Switzerland OSS office, OSS being America's wartime intelligence service, the very people in charge to a considerable extent of directing America's wartime policy and American policy in general, had also had very close ties and were inextricably bound up with the very same German industrial interests who in turn were connected with the French, and keep in mind the 51% IG ownership of one of those trusts.
Okay, back to the Nazis, go underground. By October 1942, only a few weeks before the invasion of North Africa, about 9 billion francs had been transferred from France proper to North Africa. Among those who arrived along with the money was the rightist politician Pierre-Étienne Flandin, who in 1940 had been living next to Fritz Thiessen at the Riviera, and who is now on the board of directors of both Franco-German North African trusts. Later, Pierre Pouchou arrived too. They went to North Africa to assure Robert Murphy that they would collaborate with the occupation authorities in every way possible. Whether or not this offer was made with certain reservations, whether or not a compromise had been reached, shortly after North Africa was in our hands, the American administration offered to exchange those billions of francs at 75 francs to the dollar, an extremely favorable rate, since at the time the franc had fallen to 150 francs and more to the dollar. So basically the American administration offered going in to double the going rate for franc to these French right-wing industrialists and Nazi collaborators. Still, Pouchou and Flandin and a dozen or two other French industrialists and bankers who had arrived with them didn't think that was enough, and they finally persuaded Mr. Murphy to fix the official rate at 50 francs to the dollar. So basically, two and a half times what had been the current going rate, 2 2/3. Thus, the French industrialists and bankers had succeeded in transferring many millions of dollars to a place of safety. Or had they? Perhaps it was not they who owned this money. As a matter of fact, it wasn't. It was the Germans who held the majority of the shares of these Franco-German trusts, and therefore it was they who owned the money, or most of it, and had thus succeeded in getting it safely out of war-torn Europe and exchanged into good American dollars. Hence the excellent deal engineered by Pouchou and Flandin brought them a few additional millions.
Well, basically, what we see here is the same thing that we saw back at the end of World War I. Although the United States and Germany are enemies and are in fact at war, we see that they are willing to cooperate with regard to certain things. That keep in mind now that industrialists and financiers who were fearful of socialism and of the Soviet Union in particular saw fascism as the antidote to the Soviet Union and certainly as the prevention, no, the preventative to keep socialism from arising anyplace else in the world, so that the preservation of fascism was very much identified with the preservation of capitalism in the minds of many key industrialists, so that although the United States and Germany are ostensibly at war here, they are at the same time willing and quite obviously did cooperate in order to preserve the forces of reaction in the part of the world where the American forces had put down. Now this, and keep in mind again John J. McCloy's role in North Africa and other places, and his being Hitler's personal guest at the 1936 Olympics. Now, the very same pattern that we saw in North Africa was to hold true in many, many areas throughout Europe as the Western Allies moved in. Unfortunately, they were not nearly as willing to remove fascism in actuality as they were nominally. Now, going back to The Nazis Go Underground by Kurt Rees, just as they did in North Africa when the Allied armies invaded Italy, they returned the fascists to power, although the very top fascists, like Mussolini and so forth, were not, they were chased from power. Their underlings in the entire fascist bureaucracy and infrastructure were simply reinstated. Now, keep in mind that in Italy, you had a very, very strong partisan movement. After Mussolini capitulated, the Nazis occupied Italy, kept it in the fascist camp, but were met with ferocious resistance on the part of the anti-fascist partisans, many of them grouped around the Communist Party and other left-wing parties, but by no means all leftists. But the militarily significant resistance in Europe tended to be by the Communist Party and its allies, and although the Western allies would work with them as long as these territories were held by the fascist armies, they quickly turned on them when they moved into these countries. Now, when the Allies invaded Italy and occupied Italy, one of the first things they did was to allow King Victor Emmanuel II to remain on the throne. Now, although he had never actually become a fascist himself, the king had cooperated wholeheartedly with fascism throughout, had endorsed the extermination of Italian Jewry, the extermination of Italian socialists, the invasion of Ethiopia, or Abyssinia, as it was called then, and had, in general, worked hand in glove, and apparently willingly so, with the fascists throughout. In addition, the first prime minister that the Allies appointed when they landed in Italy was a man named Marshal Badoglio, last name Badoglio. And Marshal Badoglio had been a key member of the fascist general staff. In other words, he was a fascist military leader. And so we see a repetition of the same pattern in Italy that we saw in North Africa, where our ostensible enemies become our allies as soon as our ostensible allies, meaning the leftist partisans in Italy, as soon as the fascists were defeated, the leftist partisans, nominally our allies, became our enemies, and fascism was maintained, or at least the fascist superstructure was maintained in Italy. Kurt Rees writes of the Italian situation as follows in The Nazis Go Underground. To be sure, the Allies did not collaborate with the fascist leaders or with very prominent persons too deeply stained with a fascist past. They even arrested some of them. But they did collaborate with the great majority of the fascist officials, from the mayors of an occupied town down to the last clerk. And of course, they also collaborated with military men who had been fascists as long as fascism was doing well. In fact, they did not even seem to have any objection to Marshal Badoglio, although for 20 years that gentleman had been one of the chief military exponents of fascism. They evidently believed him when he said it was all a mistake and that he was no longer interested in politics. But was it really so? Had Marshal Badoglio become converted to democratic ideals? Did he, after he went over to the Allies, honestly try to break with his fascist past? He did not. He never made any statement in favor of democratic ideas. He never spoke about the necessity for a new order. He never renounced his past. On the contrary, he made nostalgic remarks to American journalists of all people about the Abyssinian War. That, by the way, was Mussolini's invasion of and conquering of what the country we now call Ethiopia. On the contrary, he made nostalgic remarks to American journalists of all people about the Abyssinian War. Those were the days. It never occurred to the marshal that those were the days when fascism had begun its series of attacks on other countries. No, Marshal Badoglio had not changed. Even after his surrender to the Allies, he declared proudly again in an interview with Americans that he was the third oldest marshal alive, the older ones being the German Marshal von Mackensen, M-A-C-K-E-N-S-E-N, and the French Marshal Pétain. It never occurred to him that under the changed conditions, it was at least somewhat tactless to bring up these names as objects of veneration. It never occurred to him because, as far as he was concerned, nothing had changed much. Interrupting here, the French Marshal Pétain was head of the Vichy state. He was head of state of the Vichy government, the pro-Nazi French government, after the fall of Free France. Continuing here with Kurt Reese's account. One of the first things Badoglio had to attend to was the selection of a chief of staff. He chose for this position General Mario Roatta, R-O-A-T-T-A. Roatta thus became the man in charge of the reorganization of the army in southern Italy. He set out on this business in the early part of September of 1943. By the middle of November, it was established during a debate in the House of Commons that this was the same General Roatta who had been responsible for extreme atrocities in Yugoslavia. It was he who had ordered the torturing and killing of countless patriotic Serbs. He who had given orders to shoot every Serb in uniform who had no identification card with him. He who had arranged for the beating up of the patriots in Montenegro and the crucifying of those in Herzegovina. None of the leading American or British military men had opposed his appointment. It was only after violent protests by our Yugoslav allies that Roatta was forced to resign on November 13th. 6 weeks in which this confirmed fascist could begin rebuilding a new organization within the Italian army. 6 weeks in which he could place any number of dependable men, unquote, in key positions. 6 weeks in which he could dispose of genuine anti-fascists who would later prove inconvenient, unquote. 6 weeks during which the foundation for a really democratic army could have been laid. And then he was out. And keep in mind his role against the Yugoslavian partisans, because we're going to touch on that again later. That is to say, Roatta's role against the Yugoslavian partisans, we're going to touch on that briefly later in the broadcast. Once again, Badoglio had to look for a chief of staff, and again he had a splendid idea. What he needed, so he declared, was a popular man, a war hero. Such a man would pull together the somewhat bewildered Italian troops. And he pointed his finger unwaveringly in the direction of General Giovanni Messe, M-E-S-S-E, who had been taken prisoner by the Allies during the African campaign. Marshal Messe was, of course, immediately liberated and returned to Italy. How the German generals must have grinned when they learned of this new appointment. Perhaps Marshal Messe was not a fascist, but he was a symbol of Italian aggression. He had achieved popularity as the victor of Tunis, unquote, and retained it in spite of having lost Tunis and much more territory afterward. But he was an old and tried reactionary military man, a man who represented exactly the same school of thought as that to which the German generals belonged. For him, such things as democracy and liberty and justice were simply words, and from the moment he took over as chief of the general staff, he did everything he could to hamper the actions of the genuine Italian Democrats and anti-fascists and to reinstate or keep in power the out-and-out fascists or the men who could be depended upon to steer Italy toward a future reactionary and anti-democratic course. Reading that last sentence once again. And from the moment he took over as chief of the general staff, he did everything he could to hamper the actions of the Italian Democrats and anti-fascists and to reinstate or keep in power the out-and-out fascists or the men who could be depended upon to steer Italy toward a future reactionary and anti-democratic course. Okay, and he did just that. That is to say, Marshal Badoglio and the people that he brought into power in Italy maintained fascism. And just as we saw in North Africa, the German industrialists who had these powerful international connections, the industrialists, I should say, who had the connections to the various, I guess you'd have to call it an international fascist matrix, because it had elements in the United States who ostensibly were conquering Italy, and of course the fascist industrialists were pivotal in Italy and also in Germany. It's really sort of a transatlantic industrial axis, and in Italy, Marshal Badoglio and the fascist infrastructure he left in place kept the fascist industrialists in power. And again, we're going to see some of the same international fascist connections here that we saw both with North Africa and with the Dawes and Young plan and the recapitalization of Germany affected thereby. Returning once again to the Nazis go underground. It was not only the German generals who had reason to be content with what was happening in Italy. The German industrialists, too, must have approved heartily of the way in which things were shaping up south of the Po. Their friends, the masters of Italian industry, were doing quite nicely, thank you. In fact, as far as they were concerned, it was Algiers all over again. To name just one, Alberto Pirelli, P-I-R-E-L-L-I, one of Mussolini's early backers and an official in the fascist government, was left completely unmolested. The Allies didn't seem to care that he had been one of the main organizers of the Fascist Confederation of Industrialists and a member of the Grand Fascist Council. Pirelli is one of the leading industrialists of the world. He has numerous plants in Italy for the manufacture of all kinds of rubber products, wire, and cables. He also possesses sources for the material. He also possesses sources for the material which go into these products. His company has subsidiaries in Yugoslavia, Romania, Switzerland, Denmark, Belgium, France, Portugal, Spain, England, Brazil, Argentina, Egypt, and the Dutch East Indies. Up to 1939, all these properties were owned by a Belgian holding company, of which Pirelli organized to evade high taxes in Italy. Then, evidently afraid of the approaching war, he shifted his properties to the care of a Swiss holding company. When England and the United States compiled their blacklists, he was able to keep his subsidiaries in Latin America off these lists. This was easy enough. The Swiss holding company merely had to deposit bonds with the Bank of England as security for the promise not to do business with the enemy. The president of the Bank of England, interrupting here, was none other than Sir Montague Norman, the fellow who was very close to Hjalmar Schacht, Hitler's finance minister, and who was instrumental in Neville Chamberlain's rise to prime minister. Keep in mind that Montague Norman, through the Bank of England, funded Hitler directly. Returning again here to Kurt Reese's narrative. The Swiss holding company merely had to deposit bonds with the Bank of England as security for the promise not to do business with the enemy. The amount deposited in bonds was about $50,000, a tiny fraction of the business which Pirelli did every year with the enemy. In April of 1943, when the president of Brazil wanted to take Pirelli's possessions over as enemy properties, the British embassy in Rio de Janeiro protested that the Pirelli company was neutral property. It may be added that Pirelli's companies are closely interwoven with the IG Farben. Yes, it was Algiers all over again. And I think that passage pretty much speaks for itself. Again, we see the IG Farben connections, the same sort of connections we saw in North Africa and before.
Okay, now, to pull this back together into a slightly more sort of an overview sort of form, so you can understand the point that we're getting at. Now, a lot of people bogged down in this various and sundry information about World War II may begin to lose the point and be saying to yourselves, well, what does this have to do with the Cold War? Okay, I realize sometimes it's hard to see the forest for the trees. What we're trying to show you here is the pattern that develops whereby you can almost look on, in many ways you can almost look on World War II as far as the industrial interlock, the capital that knew no boundaries, as being an unfortunate happenstance that really wasn't, they weren't going to let them throw them off their game very much. And in fact, you can see that as World War II was drawing to a close, they were already remaking all the old connections so that the very people who had instigated World War II for whatever their own personal reasons were in their various countries were in fact being welcomed back with open arms into the international financial community that they had never really left, and that we have this almost seamless transfer of power from family to family and oligarchy to oligarchy. All of it still mostly set and determined to be used and pointed towards the eventual destruction of the Soviet Union. Now, we've seen this as almost an unbroken line, that World War I And the necessities of rearranging the world after World War I did not dissuade these people, and World War II itself, in all its horror, did not dissuade these people from keeping the destruction of the Soviet Union as their first and primary goal. And we're going to look at another example where not the Soviet Union itself, but democracy in the form of socialist, leftist, and centrist coalitions were forced out of power once again by the Allies, the very Allies who would not have probably been able to conquer the country without the help of those self-same partisan coalitions, namely this time in Greece.
Right. Now, basically in both Greece and Yugoslavia, you had two Balkans countries. You had the same sort of pattern holding. Now, you had fierce partisan movements, which, in other words, guerrilla warfare units, which, for all intents and purposes, routed the Axis forces in both countries. And in both countries, you had what were called anti-fascist coalitions, which were both centered around the communist partisans, but embodied sort of a mixed bag of groups, most of them left of center politically, but in general, they were all opposed to fascism.
Now, in most cases, these groups were centered around the communists or the socialist, Marxist, whatever you want to call them, groups, not because of the fact that they were centered on that ideology, but because of the fact that the communist groups, in most cases, were the only structured resistance to fascism. And we see this now in Central and South America. In El Salvador, the left has, the opposition has coalesced around the leftist groups, not because everybody opposed to the El Salvadoran military juntas has been a Marxist by any means, but because these were the only people who were actively opposing them and the only people that had the structure put together to carry on opposition.
And another point to make, I think, in that same context is that ideology, sort of developing what Nip Tuck said a little further, ideology really was not the key here. They were not the communist partisans, and the center, sort of the linchpin of the anti-fascist coalitions, both in Greece and in Yugoslavia, were the partisans, the communist partisans. That they won popularity not because people adhered to a Marxist ideology, but because, as Nip Tuck said, they were the only organized resistance, and indeed, it was the very tight organizational discipline of the communists which won over the population, specifically the various domestic fascist groups and the Italian and German fascist occupiers routinely plundered all of the population groups in both Yugoslavia and Greece and the other nations. Whenever a German or Italian column or else someone of the domestic fascist groups either in Germany, or either in Greece or in Yugoslavia, would go through an area, they would frequently massacre the population and always take what few possessions they had left. In other words, they'd take all of their stock animals, their food, any jewelry, anything that was of any real value. In particular, foodstuffs and clothing were taken from them, so that starvation and economic privation in general were a way of life, not just because of the harsh conditions imposed by the occupation, but also because the fascist elements routinely plundered the population. And in both Greece and in Yugoslavia, what I guess the main selling point for many population groups initially opposed to the partisans, the left coalition, was the fact that the partisans would not plunder when they would go into an area, so that rather, as we saw perhaps on the other side of the spectrum with Herbert Hoover, the prime mover here, the main motivational factor, is not ideology, but rather the sort of physical stuff, the goodies. Basically, Hoover had $1 billion in 1912 dollars in Russia. He didn't want to lose that. And the main reason why the communist-led, and I say communist-led partisan bands, the anti-fascist coalitions in Greece and Yugoslavia prevailed, was simply because they treated the population right. They knew, people knew that when the partisans were in control of an area, they got to keep their goats and their milk and everything else, and indeed, partisans were meted out extremely harsh punishment to anybody who broke discipline. In other words, a partisan who took a cup of milk or a goat from one of the population was summarily executed. And this was the single greatest selling point. So that the ideological factor here is perhaps for our purposes today almost a stumbling block in terms of our understanding, that it was the way they treated the population and specifically their military resistance to fascism and the lack of looting which won over the populations in these two areas. Okay, now in Greece, in both Yugoslavia and Greece, the left of the anti-fascist coalitions led by the communist partisans kicked out the fascists. In other words, they militarily defeated the fascists. Now, the Red Army moved into Yugoslavia, and so basically Tito and his communist partisans remained there, although they very quickly established an independent attack from Stalin, who was irritated with Tito because Stalin wanted Tito to conform to his wishes and to cooperate with the Western allies who wanted a piece of Yugoslavia. Tito, who along with his partisan organization had basically endured pure hell in order to free Yugoslavia from Nazi occupation, there were many brutal campaigns of extermination. They were not about to give up what they had won, and so they simply, this was the start of the break of Yugoslavia from the Soviet bloc, is that Stalin was thinking in terms of great power diplomacy, and Tito simply wanted to retain the independence they'd won through force of arms. Now, in Greece, the British landed, and because the British were opposed to communism, they immediately undertook to remove the Greek partisans who, just like the Yugoslavian partisans, had militarily defeated the fascists. Now, when the British, quote, retook Greece, unquote, from the Nazis, they lost a grand total of 3 soldiers because the Greek partisans had been so effective in reducing the Nazi resistance in Greece. I'd like to read you now from a book called The Kapitanios. Well, actually, we're going to take up now some information from a book called The Kapitanios. Now, The Kapitanios is the story of the Greek partisan movement. It's authored by a man named Dominique Udesh, last name E-U-D-E-S. It was copyrighted in 1972 by the Monthly Review Press, a softcover edition. Now, the story of what happened in Greece after the British landed, and keep in mind, the Axis powers had been driven out, is related by Dominique Udesh in The Kapitanios. That's spelled, by the way, K-A-P-E-T-A-N-I-O-S.
All right. Now, bear in mind, we're talking about several different groups here that the British found themselves in contact with. The security battalions, or sometimes called the security forces, were in fact the local fascist groups that had been had taken power during the time of World War II and under fascist domination. The groups, yes.
Yeah, they were very similar to the Vichy French. In other words, these were the Greek collaborators. The security battalions were the domestic fascist militia here.
All right. Now, at the time that the British came in, of course, owing to a series of agreements that had been made, the British were to, in fact, disarm these fascist groups and to offer no resistance to democratic movements within the countries that they were supposedly liberating and to allow them to start to form their own governments again, et cetera, and in fact, mostly in to disarm and disenfranchise these various fascist groups. Now, reading from the Kapitanios by Dominique Udesh, it says, "The promised purge," meaning the purge of the fascists, "had not yet taken place. It was not due to happen for a long, long time. It was written into the Caserta agreement that, quote, the security battalions," those self-same fascists, "will be regarded as enemy organizations and will be treated accordingly, except where they give themselves up on the orders of the military command of Allied forces in Greece." For the time being, they were left pretty much alone in the capital. Scobie's orders to Spiliotopoulos, military commander of the Athens region, had been extremely indulgent toward them. Quote, "When the Germans withdraw or surrender, you will instruct the battalions to desert to their homes and hide, or to surrender to our forces." Scobie had no hesitation in nursing the former pro-German militia with an eye to recruiting them for the coming civil war. The security battalions, which surrendered to the British, were regrouped in the Peloponnese and Chalcidice, where they were not only not disarmed, but trained by British instructors in the handling of modern weapons. As the Feldgrau, or Field Grey, tide ebbed away to the north, meaning the Germans, the British were preoccupied with preventing a resurgence of ELAS, E-L-A-S, activity, that is, the partisans, communist-led, non-anti-fascist partisan group. The British were preoccupied with preventing a resurgence of ELAS activity, and no operations on any large scale were mounted to transform the precipitate withdrawal of the Reich's soldiers into a fully fledged rout. Hampe noted during the retreat that his column was frequently flown over, but never attacked by British aircraft. On the road, it met various EDES units accompanied by British officers. Everyone would continue about their business with a courteous salute. It was more like a relief than a pursuit.
All right, very quickly, a couple of names there. Scobie was the British military commander in Greece. Hampe was the outgoing German military commander. ELAS, E-L-A-S, was the army, the actual military wing of the anti-fascist coalition in Greece. And another name you're going to hear here in just a second, EAM, was the National Liberation Force, or the political component of the anti-fascist coalition. Okay, now, take note of the reference in that passage from the Capitanios that Niptuck just read, which talked about the coming civil war, because the British, from the moment they landed in Greece, were determined to oust the communist partisans, the anti-fascist coalition which had taken power there, and remember that they were allied with this anti-fascist coalition. Nonetheless, that did not stop them from planning and eventually undertaking open military operations against the partisans in direct violation of the Tehran Agreement between Roosevelt, Stalin, and Churchill, which forbade any troops retaking a country from fascism to use those troops for any purpose other than combating fascists. And yet, in spite of that agreement, listen to the following paragraph from a dispatch from Prime Minister Winston Churchill to Foreign Secretary Anthony Eden at this time. I believe it was Anthony Eden, Foreign Secretary. Anyway, to the Foreign Secretary. In my opinion, having paid the price we have to Russia for freedom of action in Greece, we should not hesitate to use British troops to support the Royal Hellenic Government under Mr. Papandreou. Andreas Papandreou, or rather George Papandreou, was the social democrat who the British had selected in order to, as the head of state in Greece, in order to further their own anti-communist aims there. His son, Andreas, is currently president of Greece, by the way. Continuing here with this memo from Churchill to the Foreign Secretary. This implies that British troops should definitely intervene to check acts of lawlessness. Note, acts of lawlessness. We're going to examine the definition of that in a second. Surely Mr. Papandreou can close down EAM newspapers if they call a newspaper strike. I hope the Greek brigade will soon arrive and will not hesitate to shoot when necessary. Why is only one Indian brigade of the Indian Division being sent in? We need another 8,000 or 10,000 foot soldiers to hold the capital and Salonika for the present government. Later on, we must consider extending the Greek authority. I fully expect a clash with EAM, and we must not shrink from it, provided the ground is well chosen. 3 weeks after the liberation of Athens, EAM, which had suffered 3 years of furious combat and enjoyed the support of the great majority of the Greek nation, note that phrase, was suddenly the declared enemy of Churchill's Greece. In writing, quote, I fully expect a clash with EAM, unquote, he was not speculating but giving expression to a wish, a settled objective which was to be the outcome of 3 years of systematic manipulation. So keep in mind that in this dispatch, Churchill basically is basically declaring war for all intents and purposes on a movement which had, as noted there, the overwhelming popular support of the majority, the solid majority of the Greek population. And still later, Yudesh notes of Churchill and his November 7th directive to the Foreign Secretary. Churchill had been trying to engineer a collision since the 7th of November, but ELAS was still hoping to win the political battle by showing its teeth. Scobie issued more proclamations. On December 2nd, aircraft showered the capital, that is Athens, with leaflets. Quote, I am going to protect you and your government against any attempt at a coup d'etat, and against unconstitutional acts of violence. The Communist Party and EAM retaliated by calling a general strike for the next day. Athenians were asked to demonstrate in the streets on Sunday, the 3rd of December. And this demonstration here, of course, is the popular demonstration to oblige the British to abide by their treaty to remove the fascists from power in Greece. Recall in the passage Nip Tuck read, the security battalions, the fascist militia, were not only kept in power, but were being salted away for a future civil war.
Being trained by the British and not disarmed in the least. All right, talking about the day of that demonstration, and reading once more from the Kapitanios by Dominique Udesh, it says, "The first procession from the suburbs marched into the square behind an immense banner of the Red Lion of Kaisariani, with all his claws out. Long live Kaisariani, cradle of partisans and revolutionaries." Another, further back, "When tyranny threatens, the people must choose between chains and arms." Many demonstrators carried a shorter slogan, "The Germans are back." The procession arrived in a solid mass at the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. A youth surged from the front ranks and, encouraged by the yells of the crowd, began a wild dance. He leapt high in the air once, twice. Suddenly, he doubled up and fell to the ground, his chest covered with blood. An automatic weapon was barking somewhere. It was a machine gun, spitting death from the roof of police headquarters on Constitution Square. Each burst chopped into a densely packed crowd, and few bullets were wasted. Another had opened up from the roof of the royal palace. For several minutes, each one an eternity, the firing continued. The crowd tried to climb over the railings into the royal gardens. People flattened themselves behind the low wall surrounding the Tomb of the Unknown Soldier. Some were trying to hide behind a big hoarding wrenched from the railings. It carried a photograph of Roosevelt, underneath, underlined by the words, "Welcome to our great liberators." The square continued to fill up as the machine guns rattled. From the distant suburbs, from Phaleros, Kokinia, Kaisariani, Pankrati, the unsuspecting sea of humanity flowed forward, hearing nothing but its own murmur. Horrified journalists witnessed the massacre from the windows of the Hotel Great Britain. It lasted 2 or 3 minutes. 28 were killed and more than 100 injured. It is quite unthinkable that machine gun nests could have been set up on the roofs of public buildings in the heart of Athens without the authorities getting wind of it. "British troops," wrote Leeper, "had been standing by in the neighborhood of Constitution Square in case the situation got out of hand, but they were not needed," unquote. Leeper is, of course, an historian who wrote When Greek Meets Greek in 1950. Whatever the specific contribution made to this incident by the authorities, whether it was by virtue of direct responsibility or through more or less deliberate negligence, it is quite clear that the government's refusal to purge extreme right-wing groups had led to a situation which made some kind of confrontation absolutely inevitable. The collision anticipated by Churchill in his 7th of November dispatch to Eden had been engineered in the most monstrous manner.
Now, a thing that's worth noting is that eventually these sorts of provocations in which basically the fascists in Greece were allowed to go about armed, in essence to retain their arms, this inevitably led to a state of de facto warfare between the ELAS, the Anti-Fascist Liberation Army of Greece, the partisan movement, and with the fascists who were left in Greece. Now, the ELAS began military actions against the Greek fascists. They pointedly refrained, at least initially, from attacking the British because the British were their allies, and they knew that if they fired on the British, then the British would undertake full-scale military operations against them. So they simply confined their military actions to opposing the Greek fascists. However, this did not stop the British from becoming involved and evaluate whether or not the British, how conscious the British support for the fascists may have been. In other words, whether or not allowing the fascists to set up machine guns on the roof was an accident, or whether it might have been a deliberate achievement of British policy, as you listen to the following.
And especially also in light of what we heard earlier about Winston Churchill's determination that there was going to be a collision. Okay, in the Philopapau district, near the Theseion, The Grivas organization was defending the building it had occupied since the liberation.
Interrupting, the Grivas organization, also called the X organization, G-R-I-V-A-S, that is a reactionary general, sort of a domestic Greek fascist who, with his organization, had served as sort of the strong arm men, the secret police, and the muscle men, the goons, for a series of reactionary regimes in Greece, even before the Nazis, but they were then co-opted by the Nazis and put to work by them.
These people specialized in hunting Democrats, and had done so with some success under every regime. They were unanimously loathed by the Athenian population. The assailants swept towards the building, attacking with terrible violence. They were suddenly stopped in their tracks by the appearance of British tanks. Firing on the British was formally forbidden, and the firing ceased immediately. Grivas's men emerged from cover, clambered onto the tanks, and were almost all driven away, clustered round their turrets. The Andarte's guns were muzzled by the order not to open fire on the, quote, great liberators of Greece. The Asphalia, sinister headquarters of the Athens CID, was a symbol which had to be destroyed. It was attacked during the night from the entrance to an underground station, which opened onto the pavement a few yards from the building. The first attack was mounted by the young communists of an EPON group, adolescents aged between 13 and 16, carrying submachine guns or brandishing SCOBY preserves, fell to the defenders' volleys. A second wave gained a few more yards. The defenders waved a white flag and negotiations began. At that moment, a British tank and half-track drew up between the two sides, as they had in Philopappo. Through an interpreter, the captain commanding the detachment spoke to the attackers, "You have to let us take these men away. They are our prisoners." On the evening of the 4th of December, perceiving that events had progressed to a stage where no intimidation would be able to contain them, Papandreou resigned, or rather tendered his resignation. The final decision was Churchill's. The ELAS Central Committee was still hoping that the affair could be settled between Greeks. At 4:50 a.m. on the 5th of December, after a long discussion with Eden, Churchill cabled, "Prime Minister to General SCOBY, Athens. 1. I have given instructions to General Wilson to make sure that all possible forces are left with you and all possible reinforcements are sent to you. 2. You are responsible for maintaining order in Athens and for neutralizing or destroying all EAM ELAS bands approaching the city. You may make any arrangements you like for the strict control of the streets or for the rounding up of any number of truculent persons. Naturally, ELAS will try to put women and children in the van where shooting may occur. You must be clever about this and avoid mistakes. But do not hesitate to fire at any armed male in Athens who assails the British authority or the Greek authority with which we are working. It would be well, of course, if your command were reinforced by the authority of some Greek government. And Papandreou is being told by Leeper to stop and help. Do not, however, hesitate to act as if you were in a conquered city where a local rebellion is in progress."
Now keep in mind that he's talking about an allied nation and a military fighting force, the ELAS, which was part of the Allied coalition, albeit it was a communist-led organization. But here, quite obviously, Churchill has simply decided to wage war against ELAS in direct violation of the Tehran Agreement. So here, the British Army is being contemplated in use against the partisans. Now, eventually, with the sort of provocation that was in that passage that Niptuck just read you, with the British coming in and rescuing the Greek fascists at the moment of their sort of incipient liquidation, I guess you might say, eventually ELAS did wind up in an open armed confrontation with the British. They fired on the British. The British then responded with full military force and began a wholesale military campaign against the Greek partisans while World War II was on. And this led into a fierce Greek civil war which raged for several years after World War II.
Now, wrapping up this section of the show, we're going to talk about one more thing very briefly. Now, this has a couple of connections earlier back in the show. You remember we talked, first of all, about the active aid within the U.S. press for fascist groups and the active slanting of information to, in all cases, put partisan groups, communist groups, leftist coalitions, anyway, anti-fascist groups in the worst possible light. We also talked about the fact that Alger Hiss, the gentleman who was the counsel for the Nye Committee investigating industrial support for fascism in America, made some very bad enemies within the industrial sectors, and that he was eventually put away as a quote-unquote communist spy by the testimony of a man named Whitaker Chambers, who Ronald Reagan just gave the Medal of Freedom to. And thirdly, as Dave reads this last little part, bear in mind what we've just described to you about the situations in such places as Yugoslavia, Greece, North Africa, etc., as regards the treatment of partisan governments by the invading allies.
The following letter was written to the New York Times on Sunday, March 11th, 1984. The writer, by the way, is Ms. Dorothy Sterling, S-T-E-R-L-I-N-G, and the caption here, the notation underneath her signature, is as follows. The writer, a Time Incorporated employee from 1936 to 1949, was assistant bureau chief in Life's News Bureau from 1944 to 1949. And Dorothy Sterling writes as follows. Whitaker Chambers, odd choice for the Medal of Freedom. To the editor, many of my former colleagues at Time Incorporated will share my feeling of consternation at the news that the Medal of Freedom is to be awarded to Whitaker Chambers posthumously. We still remember his reign as Time's foreign news editor, which began in the hopeful summer of 1944 when Allied armies were marching across Europe. Time's foreign correspondents, men like Charles Vertenbaker, John Hersey, Richard Lauterbach, Stoyan Pribichevich, and Percy Nauth, K-N-A-U-T-H, reported the emergence of popular governments backed by partisans who had been fighting Hitler. The readers of Time never saw these dispatches. Whitaker Chambers suppressed them, rewrote them, distorted them, tailoring the news to make it conform to his own right-wing view of world affairs. From Paris, Charles Wurtenbaker protested Time's story of red riots, unquote, which had been substituted for his cable describing France's orderly new local governments. Pribichevich's reports from Yugoslavia telling of the slaughter of partisans by Draža Mihailović never saw print. So many of John Hersey's stories from Moscow were suppressed that he stopped sending political news and confined his cables to accounts of Shostakovich's newest symphony and other cultural events. Reporting from China, Theodore H. White saw his criticisms of Chiang Kai-shek's autocratic regime replaced with encomiums of Chiang as a defender of democratic principles. When researchers in Time's New York office protested the inaccuracy of the foreign news reports, Chambers habitually replied, quote, "Truth doesn't matter," unquote. The facts had to be altered to fit his anti-communist crusade.